Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Colley neighborhood in outer northeast Portland is one of the most culturally diverse communities in Portland. And for many decades, it has been the most overlooked and underserved community as well, with more than its share of poverty and less than its share of environmental assets. Verde, a community-based organization, was born in the Colley neighborhood to build environmental wealth through social enterprise, outreach, and advocacy. Verde's mission is to advocate for and organize with low-income people and people of color to drive environmental resources into their neighborhoods in response to existing needs. Today we talk with Verde's executive director, Candace Avalos, about the community needs that Verde has created to fill and how its advocacy is driving new environmental investments in low-income neighborhoods. Candace, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we were just talking a few weeks ago here on this show about the charter change that's on the ballot. And I just kind of was thinking this moment about how maybe there's a connection between what's been going on in the Colley neighborhood and other communities of color and other neighborhoods that are overlooked across the city and the kind of representation we have at the city level.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that we like to say at Verde is that we do our work in Colley as a place-based type of organization, but also Colley is a symbol of an environmental justice community that we advocate for across the state.
Let's talk a little bit about what environmental justice means, because it's one of those things that always comes up every time I talk to anybody about the Colley neighborhood.
Absolutely. So it's important to know that often climate justice and environmental justice are used interchangeably, but they are different in the sense that, you know, when you think about climate justice, obviously you think about climate change and the effects that climate change are having on our environment. But where environmental justice veers a little differently is it's also talking about just livability. It's about what your environment physically looks like around you. How do you have access to different types of resources, whether that's having public transportation nearby, having parks, whether you are able to participate in the green economy and have access to green jobs. And overall, you know, what is your quality of life, whether that's your drinking water, your air you breathe. And it's in particular to communities of color who often are facing the harshest effects of climate change.
Well, I think that some of the issues in the Colley neighborhood came to the forefront a few years ago. I remember I was driving to KBOO to do this show, and there was this immense black cloud in the sky. And at first I thought it was right by KBOO. And as I started driving more north, I realized it was a little bit further north, and it was to the east. And it turned out that there was an automobile recycling place that was massively on fire.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about that incident, because I wonder how much that was after I think Verde had started.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder how that interfaced with what was going on with Colley in terms of organizing.
Yeah, so that was a tire fire that happened. And as you can imagine, that black cloud was really toxic to breathe. And it really affected the Colley neighborhood. You know, Verde, yes, we were an organization at that time. And it was an opportunity for us to really activate all of our grassroots engagement that we had been doing. And so we actually, out of that fire came a lot of new programming. For example, neighborhood emergency response teams, being able to communicate with community about what to do in those kinds of situations. Because a lot of it too, you know, we were predominantly Latinx serving and communities that speak Spanish, some that only speak Spanish. And emergency alerts weren't often translated into other languages. And so people would be left out of what to do. So Verde stepped in that moment. And it was just another example of how when we have a community that is often living right next to different industries and things like that happen, where a tire fire happens, we're feeling those direct effects. And so Verde was there to fill the gap in communication, in advocacy, and to, you know, long-term talk about how we create a healthy environment.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the lay of the land of Colley. Besides that, that business that had the tire fire, I understand there's an awful lot of other polluting industries. And then there's also these railroad tracks right in your neighborhood that carry oil trains. So let's talk a little bit about how Colley maybe has a little bit of an excessive amount of toxic industries and how that, I'm kind of curious, but also what created that situation?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of things that create it. And I think it's important to look back in history, in the history, the racist history of redlining. That is super connected to what we experience today, because essentially, you know, nobody wants to live next to a giant polluting industry, right? That's just a very basic, like, human need that we don't want to be living next to that. But unfortunately, you know, industry needs to be sited somewhere. And often housing that gets placed next to industry is communities of color are forced to live there due to affordability issues, due to redlining. And so this is something, again, when we say that Cully is an environmental justice community, and we it's a symbol of that kind of community. This happens all across the states, where you'll have these neighborhoods that are more wealthy, more white. They are further away from industry. They have more access to tree canopy. They have parks. They have public transportation. They have walkable neighborhoods. And then places like Cully, where depending on how the zoning goes, a lot of times they're zoning these homes next to these industries. And again, due to all of those different factors, communities of color end up living there. And so that is what we're seeing in Cully, and why we're trying to push back on some of those industries.
Well, I'm actually finishing up a radio documentary now about the communities along the North Reach of the Willamette, which is another one of these kind of sacrifice zones for industry. And one of the people in the piece, Sarah Taylor, who started the Braided River Campaign, talks about how it was actually the urban planning goals of the city to concentrate everything that nobody wants to live next to into certain neighborhoods. Right. And the neighborhoods we're focusing on in this piece are Linton and St. John's and other parts of North Portland that are really actually the western edge of Albina. Mm-hmm. But Cully is the same situation, though I have a feeling that is a little bit later in the development. Now, do you know when all this industry came to Cully?
I am definitely not the expert on the dates. I'd have to go back and look for the exact dates.
Because my sense about it, because I know I was actually not that familiar with Cully neighborhood until maybe like 20, 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But my sense is that it was not that long ago, comparatively speaking, that Cully was farmland, mm-hmm. whereas the areas close to the Willamette River were industrialized over 100 years ago.
Right.
So I wonder if that's also shaped the kinds of toxins that are being produced by the industries in Cully, that it's a little bit further away from the river.
Yeah, definitely. And again, I think that Cully just, as the city was growing, as the need was growing for placing different industry and just growing of housing as the population grew, it just kind of created this like pocket of the community where, again, you had all of these industries, and then affordable housing started getting built. And that's something that, you know, Verde, along with many different partners in the neighborhood, are pushing for. But then, you know, you have this like issue, this catch-22 of like, yeah, there's this land and we can build on it, but then we're not making good decisions about, you know, how to protect people that need to live next to industries that we also need.
I wonder how much we need some of these industries. That plant that had the fire, the tire fire,
right?
I really wonder if that plant needs to exist. And there's another plant, and I can't remember what it was, but I did a show about it about a little over a year ago.
Are you talking about Owens Brockway?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Which actually has closed. Is that true? Or have they at least they stopped doing some of the nasty stuff they were doing?
Yeah, I mean, that was actually a really big policy win for Verde, and it was a way that we activated our base of community that we've been working with for decades, and almost two decades. feels a lot longer. And then the policy work that we were doing at the state level to push DEQ in particular to tell Owens Brockway that they needed to stop, you know, having billowing clouds of toxic air into the community. And so it's the win was that DEQ said you either have to shut down or you need to, you know, mitigate these pollutants. And so I know that's all like in the process of being dealt with. But that was a big important win because it showed that the way that community showed up and said, you know, we're tired of this, you know, polluting our air. Kids were coming into their homes after playing outside with their clothes smelling all funky. The tire fire is another example of just the way that the air quality in Cully is really a huge issue for that community.
Well, what were some of the early things that people started organizing around? Because another thing that's been an issue at Cully until recently was there are no parks, no natural spaces.
Yeah.
And it's kind of ironic since I do remember when that area was full of natural spaces before all the industries started getting built up.
Right.
So how did the organizing start and the out of which grew Verde?
Yeah. So actually, Verde started out as a little kind of project out of Hacienda CDC. So they are a predominantly Latinx serving, housing developer that has built a lot of different developments in Cali. And we were essentially, our founder, Alan Hippolito, was working at Hacienda at the time and was doing some green education work with the Hacienda residents. They were doing some naturescapes and doing work on like stormwater. And so that kind of grew into this need that we felt there was a green divide. And the origin story of Verde was seeing, okay, there's these organizations that are working with communities of color like Hacienda and, you know, focusing their efforts on what those communities need. Then there's organizations that were working on climate justice issues and, you know, climate change. But the intersectionality of race and environmental justice and economic justice was where Verde felt the green divide was. So we kind of spun off from there. And one of our first things that we started off was Verde Landscape. So kind of going on that same vein that we were doing a lot of stormwater work, rain garden work. We did a lot of like nature education. We still do that with Hacienda residents with their kids, Club Aves. And so all of that kind of that advocacy was what grew into what Verde is. And it's important to also note that, you know, Verde started in 2005. In 2010, we started the Living Cully Coalition, which is also still a big part of Cully. And, you know, that is a coalition that includes us, Habitat for Humanity, Hacienda CDC, and the Native American Youth and Family Center. And so those three, you know, being housing developers that are putting, you know, housing in Cully, it was important to have like a united strategy for how to best serve the community.
Well, it seems like it's an interesting challenge as far as getting affordable housing built, but incorporating as a key component of that connection to nature.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me think, I've been spending a lot of time driving up and down Foster Road in the last couple of weeks. And every time I go to the intersection of 92nd and Foster Road, or it's actually Woodstock, I think this is the hottest corner in Portland. And during the big heat dome last summer, it was 160 degrees at that intersection. And I look at the buildings that were built, and they all have black siding and black roofs. And they're kind of nice. I mean, they're a lot prettier than what used to be at that intersection. But I know that it's generating heat, and there's not enough trees.
Yep.
And I just wonder, what's the difference between that kind of development and the kind of development that you're trying to get going in Verde, in Cully?
Mm-hmm. Let me make sure I understand your question.
Okay.
The difference between the development happening on Foster compared to...
Well, development is basically just building buildings.
Oh, I see.
As opposed to incorporating nature into the design.
Gotcha. Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, so, I mean, I think that for Verde, so we started to go this way, but didn't finish this thought around Cully Park. So Cully Park was a landfill and now is a beautiful park that the community helped design. And one of the reasons... as we're describing, the lack of tree canopy, the lack of green space, that really affects, one, your quality of life. It affects the kind of air that you're able to breathe, and it affects the impacts of heat in the community. And so I think, you know, as we work with our coalition partners, it has been important to incorporate these different aspects of livability instead of just, a building for affordable housing is great, but if you have no access to green space, if you have no tree canopy, if you have no bus stops nearby, if you have unpaved roads, I mean, 40% of Cully is unpaved. And so that all affects the larger like livability. So I feel like that's the intentionality that we're bringing to, that Verde brings to the conversation in collaboration with these developers.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. KMUNA and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Candace Avalos, who's the executive director of Verde, about the community needs that Verde was created to fill and how its advocacy is driving new environmental investments in low-income neighborhoods. That seems to me the real key component of what you're doing is the idea of when you're investing in a neighborhood and you're trying to, like, mostly I think the old thinking is building more housing, how do you make that environmental investment and make that integral to the rest of the investment that's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that ultimately what we believe is that where you live, where you play, where you work is all interconnected, and having access to environmental wealth, which the way that we define that is that's green spaces, that's transportation, that's green jobs, that's infrastructure. That's a big conversation we're having right now in the city of Portland with the creation of the Portland Clean Energy Fund, which Verde helped to push for, because as you described in the opening, Cully has had less of their share of, infrastructure and more of their share of poverty compared to the city. Additionally, one of the big reasons that Cully Park was important to Cully was that I'm forgetting the percentage. I believe it's like 60% to 40%. Where the average Portlander is like 60% more access to green space, whereas in Cully it was 40% access. So those details are what we're seeking to improve when we're building environmental wealth. And that, you know, making sure to have a comprehensive plan that includes all of that is important to the growth of Cully, because it is growing. The community has grown. There's a lot more housing now, thanks to all these partners. And we want to make sure, too, that we're not displacing people either, because that's another thing that happens when you start investing into a neighborhood. It's like, oh, that looks pretty over there. They've got a nice park. They've got some businesses. Let's just build up a bunch of like really fancy places that then all the people that have work to make that community thrive are now pushed out. So that's another important piece of this work, is the anti-displacement work.
Actually, I'm thinking about Mississippi, Mississippi Street here in Portland, and Alberta.
Yep.
And those are, I guess, two good examples of the kind of gentrification.
Yes.
And I remember when Alberta was first getting gentrified, and I knew some young white people that were moving in there, and they felt a little guilty. They could afford it. It was one of the few places they could afford.
Yeah.
But they were knowing that they were part of this whole movement to just jack up the prices.
Yes.
And Alberta's a very different place than it was 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to keep Cully from turning into another Mississippi or Alberta?
Well, I think that, you know, one, we are also working on something with the Living Cully Coalition called a community-led tax increment financing, or TIF district. So for those that are familiar with TIF, it's actually often been used against communities of color to essentially take a blighted neighborhood and build it up and displace people. And so we're trying to flip that on its head and create a TIF district that, as it's generating dollars, the dollars are being, how to use those dollars are being decided by the people that actually live there, which is not common for how TIF districts are used. Usually it's like, great, you know, all these developers and typically, you know, leadership, they're like, we have all this great money, now let's, you know, put in all the things that we want, and then the people lose out. So I think that's one big way that we're trying to redefine how we invest in a community that doesn't cause displacement.
So how does that work on the granular level?
Yeah, so a TIF district, essentially, you draw these lines around a neighborhood. And so obviously, we're drawing the lines around all of Cully. And what it does, essentially, is all of the tax revenue that's coming in, there's like a, they put like a pause, how do I explain it? There's like a better way to explain it. Hold on, let me think. They put a cap on it, is what I'm trying to say. And then the dollars that get generated above the cap, they then reinvest back into the community. So that could be, you know, again, doing things like paving sidewalks. It could be like building buildings or creating community spaces. And so normally, you know, Prosper Portland for the city, they are the ones who manage the TIF districts. And there are a bunch of TIF districts that are actually because there are also fixed time frames. So it's about like 10 to 20 years that this happens. So it takes a little bit of time for it to generate the dollars to be able to use, but then it has a time limit. And so we're actually creating one that there are a lot of other TIF districts in the city that are coming to an end because of their time frame. So this would be a new one. And hopefully the goal, again, is having a community-led TIF. So when it comes time to say, okay, we have these millions of dollars, what are we going to do with it? People that live there are going to take part of those decisions. They're going to actually make those decisions so that we can be more careful to not say, well, let's just, you know, build this like high rise, like apartment that's going to draw in a bunch of, you know, high income people that is going to displace people. So that's essentially what a TIF is, but the difference is how it's being community led compared to Prosper Portland making all those decisions.
It's curious. Are you working with Prosper Portland?
We are.
Must be an interesting experience. I mean, yeah. Prosper Portland, who changed their name from Portland Development Commission.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. PDC.
And they were known for all the urban removal that they did.
Exactly.
So I'm curious what it's like to work with the quote new Prosper Portland.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely tricky, and I know I totally get and understand where there's mistrust, and we are trying to create this new system that is going to be unique, is going to be groundbreaking, but that requires a lot of trust building, not only with the city, but also with the community who doesn't believe that they have their best interests in mind. And I think Prosper too, I mean, there has been a huge shift in just the general demographics of the people that work at Prosper. A lot of the folks that work with us on all of this TIF district stuff they're from communities of color as well. And so there's like some new perspectives that are being brought in, which is helpful, but that doesn't fix everything. But it does change, you know, how we have the conversation. And I think we're working to build that trust and understanding that, like, it's going to take time because they have totally lost trust with communities that they, kicked out, that they displaced. So it's a tricky balance for us.
Because I don't know how much they were directly involved with the development along Mississippi Avenue and Alberta Street. I know that they had a lot to do with the Pearl District, which certainly, I mean, there is affordable housing in the Pearl District. Actually, I know a couple people who live there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the idea that people have of Prosper Portland,
yeah.
That they're basically in bed with the developers, yeah. and the builders and the realtors. And I wonder how you see what kind of leverage you could have with them that might shift them in the direction that you really want to see the city, not just Cully neighborhood, but the entire city go in.
Yeah. Well, the benefit of them, being connected to all those folks is that they have a level of power in helping shape the conversation. And we're trying to leverage that power by using our voices to do that. So I think that's a big advantage. But of course, we're trying to do something different, and change is hard. And it's when there's so many stakeholders, you know, we're kind of in the process right now where we actually had a huge win. We went to the Prosper Board of Commissioners and presented the Cully TIF, and they approved it unanimously to move forward. So we've have a couple of hurdles coming up here soon to like make our case essentially to different audiences and see that they support, but we're feeling really good that people support it. So we're, you know, fingers crossed, we feel that we're doing some groundbreaking work that actually people will buy into. But just like anything, you know, even just when we were talking about charter, it was like, everyone's like, yay, we're all happy. And then it was like, here comes the opposition that came out of nowhere. You know, like we expected them to be there, but there's surprises that are waiting for us. And so we're definitely being real intentional about not like saying, yay, we have it, it's easy. We know it's going to be hard. We know that there will be pushback because we are shifting power here. We're shifting dollars and we're putting them back into communities that haven't had access to them. And that always comes with resistance no matter what.
That whole thing of challenging power. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about it from everything from on the national level and liberation fronts in developing countries that are trying to overthrow colonial rule, overthrowing corporate capitalist rule, from multinational rule, that there's always this pushback from the powers that don't want to let go of their power. I wonder if you have any creative ways of getting these people and these forces to let go of their power.
Mm-hmm. Well, power does not, cede to just asking nicely all the time. I mean, I think there's a way to be collaborative, but sometimes you just have to say, like, this is going to make you uncomfortable, and that's what it's supposed to do. I think that, you know, at Verde, I feel like we do a really good job of building really diverse coalitions. And, you know, a good example of how we do that is the work that we do on water justice. We actually have really great relationships with a lot of legislators out in Eastern Oregon where water is scarce. And, you know, there's those communities are often represented by Republican legislators. And we're like, we all need water. Right? How can we accomplish the goal of ensuring the flow of water coming in, because you need it for your crops, you need it to drink, you need it to live. And so even though maybe like we have different positions on other social issues that they'd be like, oh, we don't agree with that. But we can all agree that water is life and that we all need access to it. So I think that there's ways to build bridges across things that we all agree we need. And I think housing is something that regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, I think people really feel like we need more places for people to live. We need more security so that people can, you know, get off the streets and be able to have access to affordable spaces to live. So I think that there's ways to build coalitions that can unite those voices. And even though, like, we're going to push back and maybe sometimes we're going to say, this is the direction we have to go. And, you know, you might not want to go with us, but we're going anyway. So I think that's always difficult work, but I feel Verde has been in a unique position to make the case to lots of different stakeholders and bring them along.
I don't think we've mentioned exactly where the Culley neighborhood is. And I do know there's probably a lot of Portlanders and a lot of listeners that have no idea where this location is that we're talking about. So let's describe the boundaries and then let's a little bit describe what the neighborhood looks like and feels like.
You are testing me with my street knowledge because everyone's always like, Candace, what are the boundaries? And I'm like, let me pull up a map to make sure. I think that there's, you know, goes up to about 42nd and Killingsworth. Like, you're thinking about that kind of area. Obviously, we're talking about Northeast. You know, Culley Boulevard, 57th, kind of runs through. And it butts up to, I want to say it butts up to Rockwood, but I'm not sure.
It goes that far east, because Rockwood's...
That's pretty far.
That's like east of 122nd.
Yeah, I don't think it goes up to 122nd. I don't remember the, like, the top of it, but...
But out there.
Yeah.
And then it goes to the river, basically.
Right, it does, yes.
So one of the things it encompasses are those infamous railroad tracks that carry the oil trains.
Yes, yes, it does. Yeah, and that's there's definitely a lot of advocacy in the community for that. There are a couple groups, particularly these are groups that like moms, parents that are advocating against the oil trains, essentially. And, you know, there's lots of efforts in the Culley neighborhood. Of course, we can't be everywhere at once, but we make sure to make ourselves known and push for the communities we represent to be heard in those debates.
You also mentioned that there's a lot of unpaved streets. I mean, my sense of Culley, though I have not recently been on as many of the unpaved streets as the paved ones, Prescott runs through, and Culley, they're all paved.
Right.
It's more like the back streets when you get off the main arterials.
Yeah.
But it also, there's a certain feeling about the neighborhood. One of the things that strikes me is that there's a lot of large lots compared to where I live, for one thing, or even probably where you live in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get a sense of what the neighborhood feels like physically, and also about that intermix of industrial and residential and how that feels.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of homes that are, you've got a lot of single family homes that are on huge lots of land. I've noticed this as someone who has been looking, I'm on Zillow and Redfin all the time, just seeing what's the real estate like out there, because it definitely has, it's more affordable for me personally as I'm looking, but also just very geographically the way it shows up is lots of, it's not close-knit neighborhoods like, you know, some of the like Hollywood where I live, where everything's a little bit tighter, a lot less sidewalks, especially in the residential areas. And then, like we said, you know, there's just, there will be a big industry like right in the heart of a bunch of homes. Like we created this video with our Líderes Verdes program. It's Green Leaders. We do this program to help people advocate for the community. And one of our Líderes Verdes participants showed us a video looking out of her window. And it's this huge pile of asphalt. And you can see it just billowing like dust and smoke. And she was like, this is like right outside my window. So that's a lot too of what communities experience there. They're like next to, whether it's lots of auto shops, lots of different industries, and they're inhaling a lot of bad quality air.
You listen to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Salem Station's KBFG up here from KODX LPFM, KMON and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Candace Avalos, who's executive director of Verde, about the community needs that Verde was created to fill and how its advocacy is driving new environmental investments in low-income neighborhoods. I just want to talk a little bit more about Cully Park, because that was this incredible discovery. I went there for the first time a little over a year ago. Actually, it was for a rally to stop Zenith. And it was a great place. I mean, you could hear the trains. You could see the trains. You also could see three mountains. Like, it was almost like you're right there in the mountains. And it was beautifully landscaped. And it was just a mind blower, because the last time I'd been in that area, which had been a few years earlier, there was no park. And I also have been hearing for years that Cully was really park deprived. So I want to talk a little bit more about how that park was developed and describe what its amenities are.
Yeah, so Cully Park is a really huge green space, like you're saying, and you can definitely see all the mountains. Like, on a nice clear day, you can see them all around you, which is nice. It does have a railroad that tracks that go kind of next to it on the left side. It has this really nice playground area that at the entrance of Cully Park, where community kids designed it. So we did a bunch of engagement with them so that they could tell us, you know, what do they want to see in a playground. So it's got this cute little like rock climbing type of thing, and lots of things to climb, lots of swings, lots of space to sit and gather. Verde goes there all the time for our events.
I've never seen a playground like that. When I was there, I was kind of looking at it and thinking that it didn't feel like a playground. It felt like this more of this creative imaginary space.
It's super unique compared to a lot of parks. It's not like your typical, like, you get a swing set and a slide. It has like this like mound that you can kind of climb, and definitely watching the kids like climb up and down, it's really cool.
Yeah, I climbed that mound. It was fun.
Oh, did you? That's funny. And then it has a ton of big open fields, which there are a lot of like soccer, activities happen there. Additionally, in collaboration with the Native American Youth and Family Center, there are some ceremonial spaces up in the park, and there's also some native plants that we have there, and there's also a community garden right next to the park. So all of these amenities, and it's huge. It has this really big track around too, and the track is nice. It has a like exercise stations, if you will. So you walk through the track and it'll be like, you know, here's station one, and you do some jumpy jacks, or, you know, so I've done that a couple of times. So it's just really meets a lot of needs. I see people riding their bikes around the track a lot. I see people just kind of laying in the grass. And it's one of those places where it is so big that, you know, it's never full in that sense, right? Like, you can go there and you can always feel like there's space for everybody, which is really nice.
I was trying to describe it to a friend I was out walking with yesterday, and we were actually on Pal Butte, which is another very large nature space on the east side. I guess it's the largest natural space on the east side, we learned. And I was trying to describe Cully Park and describe how big it was. And do you have any idea how big it is? I know it's bigger than any of the parks that I usually go to in my neighborhood or around the east side.
Yeah, I don't have the square footage, but it's definitely bigger than most parks that I've been to.
Well, what you mentioned gardens, and that's another thing. That's how I started to get to know Cully a lot better, was I was running into a number of people who had urban farms, actually. And I wonder if Verde interfaces with all the young people doing urban farms in the neighborhood.
Yeah, interesting. Not necessarily directly, but, you know, we helped create that community garden that's right by Cully Park. We also do a lot of naturescape projects in Cully. So that's one of our programs that we do, rain gardens and naturescape. So, and, you know, part of where Verde started was in helping Hacienda residents learn how to garden and just interact with the earth. And so it's definitely in our origin story. We don't necessarily do a lot of programming around that, but a lot of our, we do it more on a smaller scale with like the communities that we engage with.
I'm wondering how what you've done in the Cully neighborhood translates to other communities, because I know now that Verde is not just working in Cully, it's also not just working in building residences and natural spaces, because you're also working in Salem.
Yes.
So let's talk about how you've branched out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so in the last couple of years, we really have taken all of our grassroots engagement and put it into decision-making spaces and translating the needs into places where decisions are getting made for where to invest dollars, for where to, you know, just make sure that communities have what they need to thrive. And so our Energy, Climate, and Transportation Program, or ECT program, works really hard to work with all intergovernmental levels, whether that's local, regional, metro, and statewide. And we put a lot of our effort statewide because we feel like, again, Kali is a symbol of a lot of different EJ communities across the state. And so one of our big wins was in, let's see, this would have been 2021. We had the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign, which worked to pass a couple of bills, including the most ambitious goal in the whole country to get Oregon to 100% clean energy by 2040. Also things like helping with utility costs and the Healthy Homes Bill to help folks have access to energy resilience in their homes, because energy burden is a huge part, a huge issue across the state for sure. There are still a lot of homes that are being heated by wood stoves. There's still a lot of homes that just have a huge burden being heated by gas. And so we combine that advocacy work with the work we do at Better That Builds, which is our social enterprise, and we install ductless heat pumps in low-income homes. And so, and then this past legislative session, we worked on emergency heat relief bills, because that was, as we knew, you know, last year with having 100 people die in Oregon of heat-related illnesses. This is something that is our new normal, unfortunately, and Oregon's just not prepared for that. And so our bill was one to just ensure that we that folks, homeowners, have access to those resources. But it was also important for us that renters had access to cooling rights, because I know me personally as a renter in my old apartment, it specifically said in my lease that I wasn't allowed to have like window units, or I wasn't allowed to have these different things to help cool my apartment. And I know, you know, even since I've moved here in 2013, and every summer it got hotter and hotter and hotter. And that was something I had a close family friend who was from Oregon. And when I was moving out here, he was like, Oregon is such a, you know, it's so cool, like, you know, fresh. Like nobody has ACs out there, because I was from Virginia and like everybody has AC in Virginia because he got to, you know. And that was just something that really stuck with me as I lived here longer, because I was like, it's actually really hot here and there's no infrastructure for people to stay cool. And so we wanted to make sure we worked with like different landlord lobbies to ensure that renters had access to cooling too. So that work is really connected to and informed by the community engagement work that we do. And the bills that we're passing, these affect all of Oregon, right? It's not just Kali, but we feel that to do the work that we want to do in Kali, we have to work at that state level, because, you know, it affects more than just Kali.
I'm wondering how Kali connects with rural neighborhoods and communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really been important to us in recent years too, especially we do a lot of work in rural communities on water justice issues, but also energy efficiency is another thing statewide that, you know, the energy burden, especially in rural communities, is really bad. So we do a lot of work with Southern Oregon. So like Rogue Climate is an organization that we work with. And like I had mentioned, we do a lot of work in Eastern Oregon with different agricultural communities and legislators representing them. And we're also doing a lot of work right now with tribal governments too. There's just that connection to water again, how it affects Native communities, in particular Indigenous communities. We're working to build those kind of relationships so that we can advocate more strongly at the state level.
I'm curious how you work with Rogue Climate, which I've mentioned on the show many times. It's one of my favorite organizations
in
the world.
Nice.
I've worked real closely with them on the last project I did about Jordan Cove, LNG.
Yes.
And was amazed at how well they organize.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when you were talking about bringing people together from very different political perspectives,
yep.
They had these Trump supporters on their side trying mm-hmm. to stop that huge pipeline.
Yep.
And I think actually some of the Trump supporters became a little less supportive of Trump in the process of working with Rogue Climate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we work with them on a lot of different fronts. We are part of something called the Oregon Just Transition Alliance. Rogue Climate is part of that, as well as people like Pacoon, Beyond Toxics, Opal. And so we, you know, the OJTA was one of the big pushers of the OCEO, the Oregon Clean Energy Opportunity Campaign. And then we work with them, like we said, on water justice issues. So yeah, Rogue Climate and Rogue Action are really important partners. One of our ECT manager does a lot of work in rural Oregon, especially Southern Oregon.
Now, Southern Oregon also, I think, is changing demographics, because I think the old stereotype was a bunch of these kind of off in the woods, white people with their guns and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's quite a large, particularly Latinx community.
And
a lot of farm workers.
Yep.
And so I'm wondering how that connects with what the people who live in Cully and in the other neighborhoods that you deal with in Portland.
Yeah. You know, the last census really showed us the changing of our demographic landscape in Oregon. And in particular, like you said, the Latinx community has grown immensely, especially in rural Oregon. And so, you know, we really look to, I think, because we are an organization that originally began working with the Latinx community, and language barriers were really important for us to break down. And so I think that the other thing that's important to us is there are these communities that they just don't, they're having these air quality issues, they're having these energy efficiency issues, and they just don't have the tools to advocate for themselves. And that's where we feel we fit in, and we really seek to meet folks where they're at and give them those tools and give them avenues to influence decision makers and also to become decision makers. But there's actually launching our new C4. So for those that don't know, you know, a C3 has, we're able to lobby on things, but it has its limitations on political activity.
Major limitations. I mean, Cape was a C3, so I know
there's
a lot of things we can't say.
Absolutely. And so we really felt that we were doing our community a disservice by not being able to take that extra step and say, here are leaders that are actually working towards the goals that you're seeking, and here are ways that you can push decision makers. And we needed some teeth to be able to push decision makers. So Better the Action is up and coming. We filed our articles. It's coming soon. But that's another important way that we feel we want to network with different communities and make sure that there's kind of the sleeping giant, we feel, in Oregon of Latinx community, that we think they just need some guidance and some activation and will be a really big influential voice in Oregon politics.
Well, there are some people in the state legislature who are amazing allies. Some of them were a little bit of a surprise to me, maybe. Some of them not, because they came out of the organizing community.
Mm.
I wonder what kind of relationship you have with these people. I know that I think some of them you've helped elect.
Mm-hmm.
And how that helps to build the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. The state legislature has evolved a lot, even just in the last couple of years. There's been this huge wave of leaders that are coming from our communities, that were, you know, kind of grew in our organizing spaces. ConFam is a really great example of that. We work with Con on a lot of transportation related issues. She's been a really big champion at the state level on that front. And so it's been really important. And it's another big reason why Better the Action is the direction we're headed, because we feel that For people like ConFam to really show up and enforce and stand for these things, they need to have community to have their back, or else they're standing alone on an island. And we want to make sure that these leaders that are coming in, that they have the actual support to make the decisions that we need them to make. So that's a big part of our kind of advocacy work, building relationships with these legislators. And we definitely have likely and unlikely allies in Salem, which again is how we have been able to be so successful, because we all agree on very basic things, what basic things we need, like air quality and water. And so I think that Verde has been in a really strong position to influence people and push everyone towards the side of justice.
You're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM. KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Candice Avalos, Executive Director of Verde, about the community needs that Verde was created to fill and how its advocacy is driving new environmental investments in low-income neighborhoods. Well, in the remaining minutes we have, I keep thinking about this neighborhood that's not that far from where I live in, like, outer south. It's like the outer southeast comparison of Cully, and that's it used to be called Errol Heights. It's now called Brentwood Darlington, which I guess sounds much more elegant. It's also been known as Felony Flats, and it's also, I think, a neighborhood that's diversifying. It used to be a very poor white neighborhood. I mean, in the 80s, lots of crack. I'm sure there's been lots of meth there. I mean, it's a stereotypical dysfunctional neighborhood. However, there's also this strip called Woodstock Boulevard, which is been gentrifying for the last 10 years because it has New Seasons, a Grand Central Baking, and, you know, all kinds of nice restaurants and stuff. And yet, just on, you know, either side of Woodstock is still the old neighborhood. And I just wonder if you have any connection with that neighborhood, if you're aware, if there's anything that there's ways that Verde could help this neighborhood to organize in the way that Cully has.
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of what we're trying to accomplish at Verde is create a model that can be replicated. And that's another big reason for our Verde, our C4 Verde action, because I think it's clear that we've had great success in Cully. We've been able to build strong relationships, and from those relationships, build strong advocacy and a model for how to move decision makers and how to influence them. And, you know, again, yes, we do work at the state level, but, you know, it's like we do Cully and we do kind of like Portland. And then, like, state level, we're also moving into, like, rural spaces. But we're trying to grow our influence. We're trying to grow and show people how you can, you know, bring investments into your community. How can you make sure they don't displace people as well? And how you can ensure that communities, their voices are elevated in making those decisions. And so, you know, I think we have lots of different partners that we work with that might be more specific in different neighborhoods. But I think the work we do at the state level, the reason is because it trickles back down into all of these neighborhoods. But yeah, definitely we're looking to grow, and we're looking to continue to show, you know, how to make that happen for especially low-income communities of color.
When you talk about investments, one thing I was wondering about is how are you getting investors? How do you get people to put money into these communities? And then how do you make sure that those investors are not just building hardscape stuff, but also doing all the green infrastructure?
I think that's a lot of where we come in, you know, especially in the way that we interact with the Living Cully Coalition. Like we were saying a little bit earlier about how, like, buildings are great, affordable housing is great, but if you don't have access to green space or tree canopy or bus stops, then that's, you know, not as great as it could be, right, for the community. So, you know, I think the Portland Clean Energy Fund is a total game changer for how we bring investments in. For those that aren't aware, it is a surcharge on businesses that make $500 million yearly of 1%. And all of that money is coming into the Portland Clean Energy Fund that has a commission that makes decisions on where to put those dollars. And so people submit applications, nonprofits like Verde. We have been funded for, we just got a huge grant for about $3 million for some community solar projects, also doing some more ductless heat pump installations. And so I think the reality is that, you know, that to answer your question, how do you get investors to invest here? That has been the hardest part. And I think we're deciding that, like, if certain communities aren't going to invest in us, if, you know, especially predominantly white developers that are more interested in investing in those in other communities, wealthier communities, then we're going to find other investors. You know, we're going to be creative. I think PCF is a creative way to say, like, y'all aren't pouring money into here, so we're going to find a way to get that money and make sure it comes back. So that's always the challenge. But I think also we are in a really unique moment, too, where people are like, we recognize that climate change is coming. We recognize that if we don't do something, everybody is impacted. I think, you know, climate change has been one of those things where it's like people hadn't felt it as much as they do now. And so when they feel it, they're like, oh, we have to do something. And so I think we're trying to leverage this moment to say, and when you do something, it needs to be racially and economically just. And that's where Verde comes in.
Well, getting back to Cully again, to kind of close out the show, I was thinking about all the ways that the Cully neighborhood has changed. Mm-hmm. And besides Cully Park and besides some of the other things you've been talking about, one of the things I know was an issue even 10 years ago was that there were no community gathering spaces, whether it was a community center or whether it was restaurants, bars, and coffee places.
Yeah.
And I know as I head down Cully Boulevard occasionally, there's this really great coffee house I see that's on the north side of the street.
Bison?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't there a number of years ago. And I'm just wondering what other changes there are. Does Cully have a neighborhood community center now and other stuff that more middle-class neighborhoods would have?
That's a good thing to bring up, because one of the things that the Living Cully Coalition was able to accomplish was to shut down the Sugar Shack. For those that don't know, it was on Killingsworth and 57th, and it was a strip club for a long time, and it was a lot of other things before it was that huge space that some of the history in that is that because there was such a lack of community space, people were renting out the part of the strip club to do like quinceañeras, you know? And so that's unfortunate. You know, that's not the best way to build community in a strip club. We were able to get that shut down, and now it is Las Adelitas. And just that need showed us that there was such a desperate need for community space. And so Las Adelitas is going to have a huge community area that's reservable. I think it'll be like for up to 300 people. So that is a huge difference. And a lot of these different developers like NEA and Hacienda, in their new spaces, they are adding this community space because it is a desperate need.
Now, some of the other more typical kinds of community spaces, which usually are run by the Portland Parks, like a lot of neighborhoods have community centers.
Mm.
Even Linton has a community center. Actually, Selwood has a community center, but it was taken over by the Neighborhood Association because the city was going to ditch it. So now it's the Selwood Community House.
Mm-hmm.
And swimming pools, which I think the city's been trying to shut down more than open.
Yeah.
So I wonder, is there any thought about having or working with parks to get these kinds of community centers that would be free or very, very low cost for people to use?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we've got like Alder Commons in there in Cully. So that's one area that folks have been able to, they offer like workshops and stuff. We just had like an Afro-made market there from Living Cully. But yeah, I think that's definitely part of when we talk about environmental wealth. That is what makes a community wealthy, is having a variety of ways to engage with each other, a variety of ways to gather. So that is an important part of our mission.
So what are you looking forward to in the near future in terms of going full steam ahead with where you've been for the last, 17 years now?
Mm-hmm. I think that we're in a really unique spot with the creation of things like PSEF, with there's a big need right now. I know there's a big push for energy efficiency and reducing energy burden. So things like our ductless heat pump program has really grown, as well as there's a lot of conversation in the city right now about tree canopy. We used to plant hundreds of trees every year when we had a bit of the landscape. And so we're kind of talking about how can we be a part of those solutions again. In Cully. And I think our political advocacy is huge for us. That is a way that we're translating all of that community engagement into power and base building. And so that's a big part of our vision. We actually just finished our 3-year strategic plan in July, and we're really excited to launch a new website coming up soon. We have a new logo. If you haven't seen that, I know you said you were looking at our website. That's our old website, Barbara.
Okay.
Wait for the new one.
I'm excited.
It's going to be really good and colorful. So I think we're really just trying to show our influence and increase our brand. So that's a big part of our future.
Well, Ken, it's great to talk to you again, and it's always wonderful to hear more about Verde. So thanks for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Candace Avalos, Executive Director of Verde, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends and family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KABU staff, who are still doing an incredible job of not only keeping KABU on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KABU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Ray Bodwell. Next week, we talk with Nick Caleb with the Breach Collective about the evils of Northwest Natural. We'll go out with music by Soledad Bravo. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Get your COVID shots. And remember to socially distance and wear a mask still when necessary.
El cantar tiene sentido y el cantar tiene sentido, entendimiento y razón. La buena pronunciación y el instrumento al oído. La buena pronunciación, la buena pronunciación y el instrumento al oído. Mira ese lirio que el tiempo lo consume y una fuente que lo hace florecer. Mira ese lirio que el tiempo lo consume y hay una fuente que lo hace florecer. Tú eres el lirio, ay, dame tu perfume, que yo soy la fuente, déjame correr. Tú eres el lirio, que dame tu perfume, yo soy la fuente, que déjame correr. Prisionera no canta cual solía y cantar en el espacio y en el dormido mar. La garza prisionera no canta cual solía cantar en el espacio y en el dormido mar. Su canto entre cadenas es canto de agonía, ¿por qué te empeñas pues, señor, su canto en prolongar? Entre cadenas y es canto de agonía, porque te empeñas pues, señor, su canto en prolongar. ¿Qué hago yo solo en el campo? ¿Qué hago yo solo en el campo? ¿Qué hago yo en el campo solo? Yo no enamoro ni canto, yo no enamoro ni canto, yo no canto ni enamoro.